And if we understand that and fix that in our mind, then we'll be able to answer a lot of the false ideas about waiting for Jesus to one day sit on his throne. So let's start in John the 17th chapter. And we're going to read this whole chapter. This is a part of Jesus' last prayer, or at least the prayer, last prayer that's recorded for us. It's a very long prayer, and we're only reading a part of it here in John 17. But one of the things that you have to understand about John 17 is that Jesus talks to his apostles. Well, he's really talking to God. He's talking about his apostles and the people that would believe on him through their word. But Jesus is going to talk like the crucifixion and the resurrection have already happened. Now, that's not an unusual thing for Jesus to do. Jesus oftentimes talked about what was still in the future as if it was something that had already happened. Now, that's of course, Jesus can do that because he's God, and there is no time with God, no before and after. When God knows what's going to happen tomorrow, he knows what's going to happen in 1,000 years. He knows what happened 1,000 years in the past. There's no time with God. So let's read Luke 22, 19 through 20. Can somebody read that real quick? And I just want you to see how Jesus here in Luke 22 talks about the bread and the cup and what they represent. So can I get somebody to read Luke 22, 19 and 20?
And having...
I got that. Okay, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Eileen. Why don't you read it?
This is Diana, but I'll go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. Diana, read it.
And having taken some bread, when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And in the same way, he took the cup after they had eaten, saying, "This cup, which is poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood."
Now, I think we would all agree that his body has not been given yet, and the blood has not been poured out. But Jesus, because he's God, can talk about those things that were still at that point about 3 days in the future. He can talk about those things as if they've already happened. So, now, with that in mind, and kind of understanding that Jesus has this ability, let's read John 17. That's not working the way I thought it was going to. That's okay. Let's read John 17 together. And can I get somebody to read from... verse 1 down through about verse 8, and then we'll get somebody else to read from 8 down through the end of the chapter, or from 9 down through the end of the chapter. So 1 through 8.
Jesus spoke these things, and lifting up his eyes to heaven, he said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you. Even as you gave him authority over all flesh, that to all whom you have given him, he may give eternal life. This is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work which you have given me to do. Now, Father, glorify me together with yourself, with the glory which I had with you before the world was. I have manifested your name to the men whom you gave me out of the world. They were yours, and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now they have come to know that everything you have given me is from you. For the words which you gave me, I have given to them, and they received them and truly understood that I came forth from you, and they believed that you sent me.
Hey, Faye, can I ask what translation you were reading from?
I was afraid you were going to do that.
That was New American Standard.
I love that translation.
I think it's New American Standard, but I change it every once in a while.
Yes, it is.
Okay, it is. New American Standard.
Okay, that's great. When I read, I almost always turn the these and the thous into yous and yours. So that's great. It's a good translation. Who would like to read from 9 through the end of the chapter?
I can do that. Oh, go ahead, Anne. Go ahead.
I ask on their behalf. I do not ask on behalf of the world, but of those whom you have given me, for they are yours. And all things that are mine are yours, and yours are mine, and I have been glorified in them. I am no longer in the world, and yet they themselves are in the world. And I came to you, Holy Father, keep them in your name, the name which you have given me, that they may be one even as we are. While I was with them, I was keeping them in your name, which you have given me, and I guarded them, and not one of them perished, but the son of perdition, so that the scriptures would be fulfilled. But now I come to you, and these things I speak in the world, so that they may have my joy made full in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in truth, in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. For their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they themselves also may be sanctified in truth. I do not ask on behalf of those alone, but for those also who believed in me through their word, that they may all be one, even as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. The glory which you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one just as we are one. I in them and you in me, that they may be perfect in unity, so that the world may know that you sent me and loved them even as you have loved me. Father, I desire that they also whom you have given me be with me where I am, so that they may see my glory which you have given me. For you loved me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, although the world has not known you, yet I have known you, and these have known you that you sent me. And I have made you your name known to them, and will make it known, so that the love with which you loved me may be in them and I in them.
Thanks to Anne and Faye for the reading. There's a couple of things that I want to reinforce here. Verse 11, the way he begins verse 11 is the reason why I say Jesus is praying as if the next 4 days have already happened. Look at what he says in verse 11. He says, I am no more in the world. These are in the world, and I come to thee. So at this point, we know Jesus is still with the disciples. He's still with the apostles and that smaller group that had been with him for a long time. So Jesus says, I'm not in the world anymore. Now, if you get all hung up on this, you try to say, well, Jesus' spirit has already gone to the Father, but his body stayed here. That's kind of the Gnostic approach to trying to split this out and make sense out of this. I think it's much easier to say that Jesus is praying this as if the crucifixion has already happened and the ascension is about to happen. So let's look at some specific statements that Jesus makes here in chapter 17. In verse 2, Jesus makes the claim very clearly that God had given him, that the Father had given him authority over all men. In the American Standard Translation, it says, even as thou gavest him authority over all flesh, and the him is referring back to the Son of the Son, which is in verse 1. It's not unlike the statement that Jesus makes after he's been crucified and he meets with the apostles and he gives them the Great Commission. We don't always focus on the beginning of the Great Commission, but the way that that begins is, all authority is given me in heaven and on earth. That happened when Jesus was crucified. That's when he had accomplished the work. That's verse 4. He says, I glorified thee on the earth, having accomplished the work which thou hast given me to do. We know that a big part of that work was making the sacrifice for sin. Now, he hasn't, from an earthly perspective, from the perspective of somebody that still has to live with time, he hasn't died yet. The sacrifice hasn't been made yet. But Jesus, because he can do this, says he talks as if the future is in the past. So he says, you've given me authority over all men in verse 2. Verse 4, he says, I've accomplished the work that was given me to do on the earth. Then in verse 5, he says, Father, glorify me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. So Jesus is going to return to the status that he enjoyed before the incarnation. When I say the incarnation, that's when he became a man. When he was still in heaven. Yeah, somebody had a comment.
Dean?
Yeah.
In chapter 16, the very end of chapter 16 in verse 32, where he says, behold, an hour is coming and has already come for you to be scattered, speaking to the disciples, the apostles. each one to his own home and to leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage, and I have overcome the world. This is a farewell prayer.
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. He knows that the disciples are going to be, his apostles, are going to be set upon by the Romans. And in fact, they were. And that was a scary time for the apostles. I don't really believe that when Jesus is with them in the garden, he's praying this prayer. I really don't believe they understood everything about what Jesus was going to do. Remember, when Jesus is taken in the garden, Peter whips out a sword and cuts off the servant of the high priest's ear, as if to say, you're not going to take him. And Jesus says, put away your sword. This is what I've been telling you all along was going to happen. It's happening now. So you're absolutely right. He's preparing them for his leaving. And he's going to go. See, for Jesus, the cross is the great return. He now gets to go back to where he was before he came here. And to kind of correspond with and build on what Lee has been saying, in verses 11 and 12, he asks the Father to keep them, to keep the apostles. It's as if he's saying, look, for all these 3 years, they've been in my care, and I'm going to leave. God, will you continue to watch over them? And then, if you drop down to verse 20, he extends that. In verses 11 and 12, he's talking about the 12 apostles. But then in verse 20, he extends that and he says, I'm not just praying for the apostles. I'm praying for everyone that believes on me through their word. So he's asking God to watch over the apostles in verses 11 and 12. And then in verse 20, he extends it and he says, watch over all the Christians. In verse 13, he says, now I come to thee. So he says, he clearly declares that he is coming to the Father. And in verses 21 and through 23, he says, I'm praying that you would give them glory that you've given me, which will enable them to be in unity. So the unity of the believers is something that Jesus prayed for, clearly. And it was related to what Jesus did on the cross, in the grave, when he came, when he was resurrected, when he appeared to the disciples, and when he went back to heaven. Other comments about other things that you might have seen in John 17 that's related to this. Okay.
Hey, Dean.
Yep.
Just a question. When I saw that and it talked about other Christians, does that mean us too? Or is that just talking about the Christians of that day?
No, I think it's all who would believe through their word. That's the way I believe. That's the way you
believe. Okay, that's what I chose to think anyways.
Yeah, it's all Christians throughout time that would believe through their word. Remember that the closing verses of the Gospel of John, he says, many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, but these are written so that you might believe. So I wrote this down. This is what creates belief. You're right. So let's go on. A few days later, about 40 days later, the apostles got to see something that was amazing. This is after Jesus has been crucified. He's been buried for 3 days. He's raised from the dead. He is with them for 40 days, and he's teaching the apostles all of the things that they needed to know. Can somebody read Acts 1, verses 9 through 11?
And when after he had said this, go ahead, Lenny.
After he has said these things, he was lifted up while they were looking on, and a cloud received him out of their sight. And as they were gazing intently into the sky while he was going, behold, two men in white clothing stood beside them. They also said, men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into the sky? This Jesus, who has been taken up from you into heaven, will come in just the same way as you watched him go into heaven.
Amazing. Jesus is talking with them, and then he goes up with clouds. So from the apostles' perspective, Jesus is taken up. A cloud received him out of their sight. Now, at that point, they don't know where he's gone. But the two men that stood with them, I think it was an angel, okay? That's my assumption. The angel said, why are you looking upward into the sky? He's gone. He's gone back to heaven. This is where he came from. So it's not particularly surprising that he went back to heaven. So that's where he is now. Other thoughts about things that you saw in Acts 1? Okay, now we're going to shift, and we're not going to talk about what somebody actually saw. We're going to talk about a vision that Daniel says he saw. Now, Daniel didn't go to heaven and watch this all happen. This is a vision that was given to Daniel. It describes what was going to happen in heaven. And from Daniel's perspective, this is way off in the future. But it's nevertheless true. And And in my thinking, this is what the ascension looked like if you were up in heaven, not if you were on the earth like the apostles. Can somebody read Daniel 7, starting at verse 1, and read down through verse 14?
I'll try it. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. To 14, right?
Yeah.
I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed.
Okay. So you got these four beasts, and they're like the four parts of the image that are described in Daniel 2.
I'm not going to answer that.
Somebody had a comment?
That was written, or that was predicted about 500 years before Christ was born.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. This is way back. Okay. This is something that's happening during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And we're more familiar with the four parts of that great image that Daniel saw in Daniel 2, verses 31 through 45. That was the gist of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And he talks about Nebuchadnezzar. He says, you're the head of gold. Okay. So he's talking about four great kingdoms. And it was the Roman authorities, it was the Babylonian authorities who were replaced by the Medes and the Persians. Then they're replaced by the Greeks. And finally, the Greeks are replaced by the Romans. And it was during the days of those kings, that God set up a kingdom that was never going to be destroyed. So it did happen the way that Daniel saw that it was going to happen. The four beasts here in Daniel 7 are the four kingdoms that are in Daniel, the second chapter. And God, the Ancient of Days, sits and he's going to judge these four empires. So what happened to the Babylonian Empire and the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire, that was all within God's judgment. That was all within God's judgment. And then he says, when the Ancient of Days sits and he calls these four beasts into judgment, one like the Son of Man comes up with the clouds. That's verse 13. This is what the apostles saw from an earthly perspective. Well, Daniel is seeing it from the other side. They saw him leave, and Daniel saw him come. So he comes to the Ancient of Days, and that's the Father. Son of Man, that's Jesus. That's the way that he's always referred to in the minor prophets. That's the way Jesus referred to himself very often. And when he comes to the Ancient of Days, then he is given dominion and honor and a kingdom. And unlike those four beasts, or the four kings in Daniel 2, the four kingdoms in Daniel 2, the kingdom that's given to the Son of Man is an everlasting kingdom. So remember that. That's important. It's an everlasting kingdom. It's not like the kingdoms of the world. It's an everlasting kingdom. Now, look at Acts 2. Great sermon that Peter preaches on the day of Pentecost. And Peter draws all of what they knew from an earthly perspective together, and he makes reference to the promise that we talked about last week that was made to David. Remember that promise? One of his seed would sit on the throne, on his throne, and rule forever. Of his kingdom, there would be no end, this one that would sit on his throne. But it couldn't be somebody in David's line through Coniah that was going to sit on an earthly throne, because Coniah had been told he was going to be written childless. None of his seed would ever prosper sitting on the throne in Jerusalem. Jesus is in Coniah's line. So it can't be a reference to Jesus sitting down on the throne in Jerusalem ruling. It has to be instead Jesus ruling not from Jerusalem on David's throne, but from heaven on David's throne. I mean, when you think about it, it was God that gave the throne to David in the first place. So now in Acts 2 at verse 30, what you're going to see is how Peter brings this all full circle. Somebody read Acts 2, verses 29 through 36. If somebody's reading that, you're muted.
Brethren, I may say to you confidently that the patriarch David, that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants upon his throne, he foresaw and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up, and being that we all are witnesses, being therefore exalted at the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured out this which you see and hear. For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he himself says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till thou makes thy enemies a stool for thy feet. Let all the house of Israel therefore know assuredly that Christ has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified.
So Peter nails him. The Jews that were standing there, he really laid it on them. You crucified the one that God was going to put on Jesus' throne, or on David's throne. Now, their crucifying Jesus was their sin. It didn't stop God's plan. And in reality, what we know is, though they didn't intend it this way, they actually worked out God's plan. They were trying to crucify Jesus, and God was trying to put him on the throne, and he had to have him crucified. So there's a kind of sense in which they ought to be proud that they played a part in God's plan. There's a tremendous sense in which they ought to be sad that the part that they played was they killed Jesus. But they were playing a part in God's plan. This was God's promise to David, that he was going to sit one of David's descendants on his throne. And it was Jesus. And that's what he says in verse 32. This Jesus did God raise up so that he could sit on his throne. That's verse 30. And then verse 34 through 35, we start to get an indication of how long Jesus is going to sit on David's throne. So Jesus remains on that throne in heaven until his enemies are destroyed. That's 34 and 35. So where's Jesus now? He's in heaven. What's he doing? He's sitting on David's throne. He is ruling over the spiritual kingdom. He's the king. We're not waiting for Jesus to come back to the earth and become the king. He's the king now. So when somebody says, don't you wish for a time when Jesus gets to reign and everything is under his control? Yes, I wish for that time. And I am so glad that he's doing it. Every time I make this point with a Seventh-day Adventist that comes to the door, they look at me like I have a hole in my head. They've never heard this before. This is to my way of thinking, this is just a clear statement of Scripture up to this point. So let's look at Hebrews 13. Now, this is a little bit later. The writer of the book of Hebrews is kind of rehearsing and setting out what most people call a Christology, or kind of everything we know about Christ. So this is the ultimate Christology. Hebrews, the first chapter, and I need to get someone to read verses 1 through or 3 through 13.
I got it. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become so much better than the angels, to the extent that he has inherited a more excellent name than they. For to which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my son, today I have fathered you," and again, "I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me"? And when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, "And let all the angels of God worship him." And regarding the angels, he says, "He makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire." But regarding the Son, he says, "Your throne, God, is forever and ever, and the scepter of righteousness is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of joy above your companions. And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. And they all will wear out like a garment, and like a robe you will roll them up. Like a garment they will also be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to an end." But to which of his angels has he ever said, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet"?
So let's kind of consider the things that I think are critical to this part of our study together. Verse 3, he's finished making purification for sins. That was the cross. Jesus sat down at the right hand of the Father. And there's this whole line of thinking that the priests went in and made sacrifice for sins, but the priests never sat down because they were never done. The next time they would have to make another sacrifice the next week. Because the Sabbath would roll around, they would make the Sabbath sacrifices. Jesus made one sacrifice and he sat down. He's finished. He's not going to make any more sacrifices. And that's something we clearly believe. And now Jesus is in command of the angels. Remember when Jesus was on the earth? Jesus went from being by the Father's side in heaven to a status that was a little lower than the angels. That's where we are, by the way. So he came from heaven down to our level. So at this point, the angels are above him. He doesn't command angels at that point. The angels ministered to him just like they minister to us. But then when he went back to heaven, he took his place that he had before he came down. So now he's back above the level of the angel. That's where he started out. He came down to be like us, a little lower than the angels. Then he went back to heaven. Now he's above the angels again. And so now he commands his angels. And in verse 14, he says, his angels are ministering spirits that he now sends forth to do service for the sake of them that shall inherit salvation. So now he uses the angels to minister to us, to be his servants ministering to us. And in verse 8, he said, your throne, O God, and that's a really important phrase. The Father calls the Son God. And that's important, but not necessarily for this study. He says, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. So, yes, there is a sense in which Jesus is on the throne, and his throne, his kingdom, exists forever. And he's going to stay there at least until such time as his enemies are destroyed. And I said that was verse 23. There is no verse 23. That should have been. Let's see, what verse should I have put there? Verse 13. Bad typo. And then the last thing he says is the foundations of the earth, all this that we're familiar with now, this is going to pass away. It's going to get old. It's going to run down. It's going to pass away. Now, a lot of people suggest from the statements in Peter that they think that the earth is going to be burned up. And that may perhaps be true. It's not necessarily important to this discussion whether it's burned up or it just gets old and it passes away. I tend to think that Peter is talking about something else, but that's not germane to this discussion. What is germane is that this earth is not described as forever. It's going to pass away. It's going to perish. God will roll it up just like you would roll up an old garment that got holes in it and throw it away. And Kim says that I have several shirts that I need to throw away because they've gotten old and they have holes in them. Yes.
There in that, I guess that's verse 17, not 23. But, you know, they say, people want to say that Jesus, when he reigns, that it's going to be all love and peace and whatever, but Jesus is reigning until his enemies are destroyed, not reigning when everything is all happy and peaceful and in the 1,000-year reign.
Interesting point. Interesting point. Now, there will come a time when everything is in Jesus' kingdom, happiness and light, but that's not until the rest of us get to heaven and join Jesus up there, and the enemy is destroyed. Because there is no evil in heaven. So yeah, I look forward to that time, but not because I'm waiting for Jesus to reign. He reigns now. Okay, let's get to the last passage here. This is 1 Corinthians 15. And this is the Apostle Paul talking in large measure here in 1 Corinthians about the resurrection. But he makes this statement in 1 Corinthians 15 at verses 25 and 26. And it, remember, he's talking here about Jesus is the first fruits. He has ascended to his throne. Then the end comes. He gives the throne, he gives the kingdom back to God. So God gave it to him. Now he gives it back to God. And then he says, Jesus reigns until he puts all his enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be abolished is death. So Jesus is reigning until death is destroyed. And when is death destroyed? When all men are raised. And they're not going to die again. The righteous who are raised are going to live forever with God in heaven. And the wicked who are raised get to live forever with their God in hell. That's not a happy end for them, like it is for the righteous that get to reign, that get to be with God in heaven and live forever. But the wicked are going to live forever as well. It's just that they get to spend forever in hell. Not where I want to spend forever. So I hope that sort of sets the stage. We know where Jesus is. He's on his throne in heaven. He's reigning. He's doing king work. And one of the things that he does is he uses his angels as ministering servants to us.
Is that where people get the idea of guardian angels?
It may be, Carol. I really never traced the whole development of that thought of guardian angels. That may be. The only other place that I think that might have come from is the statement that Satan makes to Jesus he says, God has appointed his angels guard over thee. So the angels did come and minister to Jesus during the after the temptation. And it is true that God is using the angels now. So remember, God is still above the angels. Jesus went below them and then went back to being above them. But during that time that Jesus was below them, God was the one that was using the angels.
Do we know how, in any particular way, how they minister to us?
That's a fascinating study, and I would love to undertake it. Chad Siktish, I believe, has written a very good book on angels. There's just not a whole lot that's known about exactly what angels do. And I think in many ways that God uses his angels in ways that we don't see it. The statement is made that they entertained angels unaware. They looked like men many times. I think that's what happened in Acts, the first chapter. They looked like men. And remember, it was angels that came and warned Lot. And I mean, they took him by the hand. So apparently they took on a form like a man, and they took Lot by the hand and hushed him or hurried him out of the city. You almost get the impression that they're dragging him out of the city. You've got to get away. I don't know that Lot knew that they were angels at that point. I think Lot recognized that they were ministers from God, but I don't think Lot maybe knew that they were angels. I think Lot may have thought they were just men. And to this day, I believe that we sometimes could encounter an angel and think it was a man. But the angel is really doing Jesus' work for us.
It's like Lee just mentioned to me. She says, well, if God doesn't tell us why, what they're doing, we don't need to know.
Yeah, sometimes that's exactly right. Sometimes he just looks at the situation and says, I got to get him out of it. And I don't think that the involvement of an angel in a man's life necessarily means that God works a miracle or suspends natural law. He doesn't have to do that. And I don't think God now suspends natural law. I think the age of miracles is past, but I still think that God works in our lives. And there are a lot of times that God is working and I don't appreciate that like I should. And the thing is, I can't always say that I can look at that guy over there. I can look at Ted. He's an angel. I can't do that. Ted made his image go away, so I couldn't see him anymore.
Yeah, I don't think that would be something you'd want to say anyway. I am an angel.
Okay, Richard.
The line there that you have there in 1 Corinthians, the last enemy is to be destroyed is death. Is the word death mean death, or does it mean the devil, or does it mean maybe both? I was just curious.
Let me look at the exact word there in 25 and 26.
Because when he says enemy, you think it's like, you know, like if we were in a fight, it would be the people. But I was wondering if he meant, you know, when he takes the last person into heaven and destroys everything, that's death. I don't know. I was just a question.
Yeah. The root word there for enemy is, let's see, it's G2190, and it really is just anyone who is an enemy.
Okay.
That's standing against us. Death is, it's a word that's used in the King James translation 118 times. And it, generally speaking, is exactly what you think of. It's the one word that I know how to pronounce, Thanatos. It's 2288. And most of the time, it's just referring to death. It, Strong says it could be literal, it could be figurative. Thayer says it's the death of the body. Metaphorically, it's the loss of life, which the loss of that life, excuse me, which alone is worthy of the name, so the loss of good life. He says it's the miserable state of the wicked in hell. I think in this case, in 1 Corinthians 15:26, it's probably, in my mind, it's probably talking about just physical death. That has been man's enemy ever since the beginning of time.
If you talk to any parent who has a child who has cancer, death is the enemy.
Yes. Yeah. Any parent who has a child with any kind of deadly disease.
Thank you.
Death is an enemy. And I am so moved by a lot of the ads that you see for the Danny Thomas Foundation and St. Jude Hospital and the way that parents talk about death. It really is an enemy. Okay. Well, we went a little bit over time. And thank you for bearing with me in all of this. But I think we've clearly established, biblically, Jesus is now in heaven. When did he go there? When in the ascension. And I freely admit that I have not talked about the ascension as much as I should have. I've talked about the death. I've talked about the resurrection. But I have not spent as much time on the ascension as I should have. And the ascension is a critical feature in all of this. So Jesus ascended to God, sat down on David's throne, and he is from there ruling forever till his last enemy is destroyed, which is death. And he's doing king stuff, and we're his subjects. So he's the benevolent despot.
So when you die, you go to the grave until Gabriel blows his horn, correct?
Yeah, until such time as Jesus raises all men from the grave. Everybody that's in the grave comes forth. All of the people that are alive and remain until that day are changed, because we can't go to heaven with the body that we have. We can't go to hell with the body that we have. So we get changed, and then we go and we go to judgment. And based upon that judgment, we go to heaven or hell. We get to be with God, or we get to be with our other God that we served while we were here, who is Satan. I don't want to be there. I want to be with God, the Father, who wants good things for me.
Amen. Amen.
But there are some people, unfortunately, who have prepared themselves to be with Satan in a lake that burns with fire. That's what they've been preparing for, just like Christians have been preparing to go to heaven. And if I know that, what that means is, I want to rescue them in the most fervent way. I can't imagine anything more important than to give them this bit of knowledge so that they don't have to go there. Anyway, West provided the perfect segue for next week. Next week, we'll start talking about what happens when Jesus comes back.